New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos. You can now download a free PDF copy or purchase a beautiful printed edition of Issue 5 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlov.
Hello and welcome. I'm Emmy Vadnais, co-host with Jeffrey Mishlov. Today we'll be exploring, is unity in polarizing times possible, and if so, how? With my guest, Christopher Naughton, who is a former prosecutor, civil litigation attorney, and multiple Emmy Award-winning host and executive producer of the American Law Journal television program. He is also a certified holistic life coach, helping lawyers and other professionals achieve extraordinary success while also maintaining work-life balance. And it is my pleasure to work alongside him as he is also a regular guest host on New Thinking Aloud. He is author of America's Next Great Awakening, What the Convergence of Mysticism, Religion, Atheism, and Science Means to the Nation and You. If you enjoy this program, please like, subscribe, press the bell icon, and share. This is Christopher's second interview on New Thinking Aloud as a guest, and he is joining us from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, Christopher. It is a great joy to be with you today on New Thinking Aloud.
Oh, back at you. I mean, always a pleasure to see you and a greater pleasure to be speaking with you as well.
It's very fun talking with you today because we are both hosts on New Thinking Aloud. And this is your second interview. In the first interview, you talked about your book, your fantastic book, The Next Great Awakening, with host and producer Jeffrey Mishlov. And today we're going to go a little bit further into these polarizing times that we're in. Can you share, how did we get here and what is the path forward?
You know, I'm hardly the first person to say this, but many great minds well before us, Emmy, have talked about the cyclical nature of history and of time. And this is also part of the American story. I mean, Native American Indians never saw time as linear. They always saw time as reflecting nature, you know, root to bud, to fruit, to seed, and back to seed again. And so that it was always cyclical. And even men such as Thomas Jefferson talked about each generation coming forward and, you know, putting its own imprint on the nation, and that these things happen in cycles. He used the term every generation or so, the tree of liberty needs to be fed or watered by the blood of, or the water bloodshed of humankind. Not necessarily what we're looking for, but he and Arthur Schlesinger, and more recently Neil Howe, who's written the fantastic book, The Fourth Turning, talks about cycles of history. Mark Twain talked about cycles of history. In fact, he's purported to have said, history may not repeat itself, but it likely rhymes. Now, he probably never said that, but I think it's still a concept that many of us do endorse. And whether it's America or Western civilization, but specifically my book, America's Next Great Awakening, really does look at the cycles of history of America. And it looks at the roots of consciousness of the nation. And so if we look at America and we look at what might be an average lifetime, about 80 years or so, America seemingly goes through a crisis, an existential crisis, about every 80 years or so. So we start at the American Revolution. 80 years later, we have the Civil War. 80 years after that, we're coming out of the Depression and World War II starts. And 80 years later, we have the polarization we're experiencing today, the Capitol riot, the political chaos and conflict that we have experienced. And generally, these so-called fourth turnings, as Neil Howe said in an interview that I conducted with him, generally what follows is, out of this chaos and conflict, is greater unity, greater awareness, greater peace. But I wrote the book essentially because, you know, I'm of the baby boom generation. I was born in a first turning after a fourth turning. So after the crisis and conflict of the Second World War, I grew up in the best of times. America was at the top of the world. Much of the world, certainly the Western world and parts of Asia were literally destroyed. America came through it largely unscathed. It was the powerhouse of the world. It was the arsenal of democracy. So we were very blessed. I was very blessed to be born at the time of Eisenhower and John Kennedy. And this is what Neil Howe, for example, calls a high. After the fourth turning is a first turning. This is when institutions are strong, unity is strong, and literally the nation is on a high. But eventually those things do break down. A second cycle comes along and people start to question. It's generally a time of spiritual awakening. People start to question that. And then into a third cycle in a four cycle generation, things start to break down. And then the fourth cycle or the fourth turning of that cycle, we generally see or feel greater chaos. And again, whether you believe Neil Howe or not, I mean, he was very prescient. He and his co-author William Strauss said in 1997, when they first wrote The Fourth Turning, that by the year 2025, America is going to go through a time period where institutions would begin to crumble, democracy would be imperiled, and that literally thousands or millions could die, or it could be the next awakening towards an age of enlightenment. So I look at it as an opportunity to use the chaos and conflict to bring us to a higher level of consciousness. I kind of look at time like an expanding helix, if you will, you know, a series of concentric circles. We're on the same place on the circle, if you will, as we were with some of those past crises, but hopefully one step, two steps, three steps up that helix.
Well, that's a very positive outlook. What do you say to the folks who may be listening thinking, well, it's just not looking really good for the U.S. or even the world at the moment?
Well, you know, the thing is, we've been through this before. Now, just imagine, and again, being myself being a baby boomer and you born even later, all of us felt like, hey, this is going to last forever. You know, it can't happen here. We can never have these kinds of problems. And we always kind of felt like, you know, I never felt that we would be facing the kind of polarization and political chaos that we're facing now. I never thought I'd live through a time where there wasn't a complete peaceful transfer of power. And if you look at the 2020 election, some people believe what the electorate said, which was that one man was elected president, but we still have a disagreement with a former president. So for those people who believe, wow, these are the worst of times, it certainly does look at that. But imagine if you were, if you will, if you were a person living on the West Coast at the time of the Second World War, or even here in my own home state of Virginia. I live here in Virginia Beach, and I've talked to people, most of them now deceased, who talked about World War II. And, you know, right outside our windows here, the Atlantic Ocean, is where German Nazi U-boats would sink merchant marine ships. And I had one gentleman tell me, you know, in Virginia Beach, where you had to close all your windows and all your lights at night and basically go black. He said on one evening, not one, but two merchant marine ships were blown up on the horizon. I mean, that would be pretty, that would test your soul. Again, you and I haven't had to live through that. My father's generation, they were called up to go to war. What would my grandmother have thought? Like, oh my gosh, my son's going to go and fight in Japan, or he's going to go fight in Germany. So we've got to dispel the notion that these things haven't happened before, that this is the worst of times. It's not great. I'll admit that. But, you know, there's something about, and this is what I try to bring out in America's Next Great Awakening. For some reason, it seems that conflict can be good for the soul, meaning that it provides grist to help move things forward. And we know that sometimes in our own lives. You know, Jeffrey Mishlev, of course, who is the ultimate host on this network and has been for decades, has always venerated William James, and I have too. William James, of course, to me, I'll quote Philip Gura, who wrote a book on the Transcendentalist. He said William James was the greatest thinker of American history. And it's hard to argue with that. I mean, he wrote the book Varieties of Religious Experience. He was exposed to every kind of mystical and religious thought or belief system in his home. He was the man who founded Harvard's psychiatry department. It was his philosophy that is the basis of Bill Wilson's AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. So he's a great mind. He basically And he was Ralph Waldo Emerson's godson. So I know I'm laying the foundation because what William James said at a Harvard talk in the early 1900s. Now, some people in that audience are still alive that fought in the Civil War, including his good friend, Oliver Wendell Holmes. And he asked the people in the audience that day, do you think that we gained from the Civil War? And of course we had. Slavery ended. Women began it was the nascent movement of suffragettism and women getting equal rights. It was a beginning of new labor laws, child labor laws, the beginning of, you know, the environmental movement. I mean, these great progressive values had moved forward. And everyone in the audience to a person raised their hand and said, yes, we've benefited. We've moved forward. We've evolved out of this tragedy. And then William James asked the people, now who would like to go through another civil war again? And of course, no one raises their hand. But for some reason, whatever it is, out of conflagration, sometimes the worst conflict, come the greatest movements forward. Now, that doesn't mean I'm sitting here wishing that we have a great conflagration so that we can move forward. But we have to acknowledge the times. They are polarized. There is conflict. Sometimes people wonder if the center will hold. And that is reasonable to ask that question. But we've always moved through that. I like what Glenn Aparicio Parry said in his beautiful book, Original Politics, Making America Sacred Again. America right now is on the precipice of becoming a fascist state. That is a real possibility. Fascism could reemerge as it did in the 1930s here in the United States. It could also be a great gate of history where we move into a new age of enlightenment. So really, the choice is ours. And I would say this, we are going to get through this. It's what happens in the meantime. What does the conflict look like? I mean, Germany is a great democracy today, but look what they had to go through to get there. I'm not wishing or promising that on any people, on any nation. But I will also say that I think the DNA marker of the American soul is unity in diversity. And I honestly don't believe that that ever could be swept away unless the entire world is swept away. I believe that America will make it through this next period and we will learn from it and we will become more unified. But we're not trying to become like Nazi Germany or fascist Italy, where they were very unified. That's what fascistic means, a tight bundle of sticks. They were very unified, but they were unified in commonality, meaning they were unified as long as you repeat after me, imitate after me. Okay, no Jews, no pagans, no gypsies, no disabled people, all blue-eyed, blonde-haired Aryans, and we're all going to march down the same path together. And really, when they were unified, look how strong they were. They built a juggernaut that the world had never seen before because they had great unity, but they didn't have unity and diversity. And that's the sole marker of the nation, e pluribus unum, out of many, one. Which is, in some ways, Emmy, it's not only a great collective marker, it's also an individual marker. We, as we're sitting here, you know, you and I are different. You're wearing something different. You're in Minnesota. I'm here in Virginia Beach. We're different people. We get that. But we also know that, and especially working here at New Thinking Aloud, we also realize the very cosmic notion of being unified, that we really are all one, that somewhere on some level, some cosmic universal level, we're one. Maya Angelou, I think, said it best. She said, you're not your brother's keeper. You are your brother. And while some might think that that might be a little codependent as egos, what I think she was saying is ultimately we are joined in a spiritual source where there is no separation. And yet you and I are tasked in this lifetime as individual egos and individual bodies and vehicles to carry out something divine.
Very well said, Christopher. We are all interdependent with each other. And like you mentioned here on New Thinking Aloud, many of the interviews on New Thinking Aloud echo each other in how there is a oneness within all of us, that the great mystical teachings around the world really all come back to that conclusion. And you mentioned that the path forward is really through consciousness. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, I think, you know, the subtitle of the book is The Convergence of Mysticism, Atheism, Religion, and Science. And, you know, going back to the time of William James or Ralph Waldo Emerson, or go back to the 19th century, and, you know, these guys and women were already starting to get involved or read up on Eastern philosophy. But that was 1/1000th of 100% of the population. Today, we have access to all the great belief systems, to the great mysticisms of the East and the West, deep scientific research. We have access to, you know, all of the orthodoxies and the religions of the world. We have been exposed to atheism much more boldly in the last 50 years. So when belief systems emerge and they converge, they create a bit of, they create a different kind of a sign pattern, do they not? It creates some chaos and conflict. Imagine you're looking at a clear lake and you throw not one, but two, but four pebbles, mysticism, religion, atheism, science, into that lake. And now you're going to have a lot of ripples bumping into each other. But again, like America itself, because we have invited in so many religions and creeds and races and genders, although it can be bumpy at first, like democracy itself, it also tends to create a new sine wave or a new wave pattern, which is richer than before. And so that's, you know, again, one of the reasons I wrote the book, because I think when you have the convergence of these belief systems, and it is happening, we're finding common ground among some of these belief systems. What that means is it's the death of fundamentalism, the death of Christian fundamentalism, the death of Jewish or other religious fundamentalism, the death of materialistic science fundamentalism, the death of fundamentalist atheism, the death of fundamentalism, which basically means I'm right and you're wrong. All of a sudden, we're noticing that healthy conflict, and there's always going to be some conflict in the world. That's not, you know, conflict can be a debate or a football match, or it can be World War III, right? But having a difference of ideas, and Jeff said it on this program before, talking about the Hegelian dialect, you know, synthesis, antithesis, new synthesis. And by having so much access to this information, sometimes it seems overwhelming. Sometimes it creates polarization. Some people want to hold on to yesterday. They don't want things to change that fast, and things are changing so rapidly now. Some people want to be out into the future, but we need to be here. So bumping into each other and bumping into our belief systems is going to create a wave pattern in the lake that's going to look cacophonous, and it's going to look like chaos sometimes. And yet at the same time, this is the greatest blessing of all. And again, that's why I look at America itself, even though there's lots of shadow work that we're still working out, and America is hardly perfect. I mean, it's always about becoming a more perfect union. You know, maybe the day we become a perfect union, we leave the planet. I don't know. But in the meantime, we're working out differences. We're listening to differences. We're being as civil as possible in an age of chaos and conflict and bigotry and fake news and AI. I mean, there's so much being thrown at us at once, but it's calling us to go up a level. It's calling us to expand our awareness, to expand our consciousness. And, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book, I don't know about you, Emmy, but I kind of grew up with this, even in growing up in a Catholic home. My mother said early on, she said, you know, all paths lead to the mountaintop. You know, which was kind of interesting for its time in the 60s for someone to say that. I mean, if you're Jewish, if you're atheist, if you're Islam, if you're Catholic, whatever, you keep climbing that mountain, you get to the mountaintop. The epigraph to my book, the great Christian mystic, Pierre Chardin, said, everything that rises must converge, which to me is similar to, you know, all paths to the mountaintop. And again, as I've discussed in my book, you know, when you get to the mountaintop, what I believe is the mystical path of every great religion. So if you're Islamic, if you're a member of Islam, Sufism is that path. In Judaism, it's Kabbalah. In Christianity, Catholicism, it's the Christian mystics. Even atheism, I mean, there is a sacred atheism that I think we have seen in our time period. Atheism has evolved. And if I may even speak to that for just a moment, which is in one of the latter chapters of my book, you know, I talk about the fact that maybe 30 or 40 years ago, well, after communism purportedly had died, when the Berlin Wall came down and when Glasnost and Perestroika became a thing in the Soviet Union broke up, and and Russia emerge from that. Atheists were able to come out and say, hey, here I am, because in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, if you were atheist, that was tied into communism. In fact, the term atheistic communism was, you know, was a meme. Let's face it. So after that fall, people of strict scientific nature or strict non-religious nature came forward and they said, hey, I'm an atheist. And in a plural society, isn't it great that you can just come out there and speak your truth and not be afraid of what some person's truth is? And I know a lot of people that just felt cowed by atheism and rejected people who were atheists. And I would just, there's a time period, a short time period in my life where I was atheistic, very short time period. But for me, that was like going into the void, if you will, and allowed me to shift to something else. And when atheism was able to express itself, I think of the Four Horsemen in the late 1990s, atheism kind of got a toehold in the culture. When Daniel Dennett and Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, and Sam Harris came forward and basically said religion is nuts and we're going to go out there, we're going to write a letter to the Christian nation and talk about the God delusion. And again, some people, certainly Christians, were cowed by that. But what was so wonderful about that was that this was an expression that was allowed to be expressed. And what happened? Some people in the atheistic camp said, you know, these guys might be onto some things, but we need a new voice. They're way too angry and they're too fundamental. And so what happened was a number of women within the movement started coming forward and they were kinder and gentler. And they were like, look, we're not going to say religion is a toxin. We're not going to say we need to flush all religions down the tube. We're an atheist, but that doesn't mean that I'm angry at God. That's actually a quote from S.E. Cupp, who's a commentator on CNN Headline News and a proud atheist. But she said, and I love what she said. She said, I don't know, maybe someday I'll change my mind. Wow. Now, see, to me, that's a person who's an atheist it's the antithesis of atheistic fundamentalism. And again, what I've loved about our founders and why we need to remind ourselves of their belief systems and their roots of consciousness, the founders maintain the notion that they could change their minds, that they could change their minds. And see, that's the antithesis of fundamentalism. And we're hopefully with the convergence of these belief systems, we're moving away from fundamentalism of any stripe. Benjamin Franklin, there are a lot of favorite characters I have in the Roots of Consciousness of the Nation, but I love Franklin the most because he could talk with anyone. He could negotiate with anyone. He would listen to people. He was brought up in a Presbyterian home, or actually a Presbyterian home in Boston, and his parents wanted him to become a preacher. And he got the hell out of there because he was not going to be a fundamentalist preacher. And he came to Philadelphia. And when he came to Philadelphia, he was approached by two more fundamentalist Christian types of that age, during the First Great Awakening. And they handed him a tract or information on deism and why it was so wrong and why people who believed in such things would go to hell. And Franklin read the tract. And he writes in his own biography, he said, not only did it not persuade me to become one of them, he said, dissuade me from rejecting deism, he said, but I agreed with the tract and I became a thorough deist. And Franklin not only was a deist, many people in the audience probably know what deism is, but deism is one of those foundational philosophies of early America that said more or less that God created the world, but then left the world to do the work that they needed to do. Some would say he was the divine clockmaker who wound the clock up and went home. I think the Freemasonry and the Unitarianism of that early age of America was far more three-dimensional or four-dimensional than the two-dimensional deism that I've just described. But Franklin was a Freemason. He went to Unitarian churches. He was a scientist, but he was able to discuss things with Christian fundamentalists, and he was able to discuss things with people who believed in Christ and people who did not believe in Christ. And he stayed very steadfast in his beliefs right to the end. I mean, Franklin actually wrote the original sayings that would go on his gravesite. He basically was venerating and agreeing with reincarnation, that he would be back again someday after the creator, you know, corrected some of the errata. He would come back in a more highly refined form. So Franklin was a believer in reincarnation. He wrote about astrology in Poor Richard's Almanac. But he was so conversant that it even ticked off people like John Adams, who said, oh, the Anglicans think he's an Anglican. You know, the Friends thought he was a wet Quaker. You know, the Catholics thought he was one of them, because he knew how to speak their language. And because he was exposed to so much, I think that's part of what is important in this day and age, is that we are open-minded, whether it's other religions, other belief systems, whether it's no, you know, I think even atheism is a belief system of sorts. I know my atheistic friends would disagree with that. They like to say atheism is a religion, like not collecting stamps is a hobby. Except if you have to collect the stamps, then it is kind of a religion. But anyway, I see these things converging. And ultimately, if we have conversations and we can share with one another in a civil way, I see us eventually, you know, getting through this.
Mm-hmm. Do you think part of the polarization is that many people want others to think like them or believe what they believe?
Well, that's fundamentalism, right? I'm right, you're wrong. Jacob Needleman, who wrote the great book, The American Soul. And again, it's one of my Bibles. It's on my bookshelf. It's behind me somewhere here. You know, basically stated out that fundamentalism is, I've got the answer, you don't. How many millions of people have died over the centuries, Emmy, from that? And I know a good atheist like Bill Maher would say, well, religion is the basis for most wars. I would say ideology is probably the basis of most wars. It can be other things. It can be land grabs and greed and power hungry leaders, that's for sure, who just want power. But it is also belief systems that think that they have the entire answer. And I think that, again, despite the chaos and the conflict, I think we're moving past that. And again, that's what I think. I mean, just last week, okay, and you know this, because when we put our programs up here on New Thinking Aloud, we put them up on YouTube, and occasionally, you know, we'll get hundreds sometimes comments of people, and you'll read a few of them. I know Jeff does as well, and some of the other hosts do as well. And one person just was really, it was like a dog with a bone. It was just like, yeah, these near-death experiences, it's just, you know, it's just the dying brain hypothesis, and this is not real. It doesn't demonstrate consciousness survives death, and they're just anecdotal stories. And I got into it with him a little bit. We went back and forth, and even my partner in life, Valerie, said, don't comment. Don't go down that road. I said, I'm going to be respectful. Well, you know, after 9 replies, if you go into the thread, after 9 replies, he said to me, because I said to him, I think we're coming to the end here, because now it's starting to get emotional. I had pulled my emotion out, but he was clearly, you know, we had definitely triggered him by talking about near-death experiences and the possible existence of consciousness after your brain and your body dies. But I said, I think we're getting into an emotional place. And I told him that a person that is an atheist who had a near-death experience that I would invite to the program. And I said, but it's emotional now. I need to back away. And he said to me, thank you. I appreciate it. You're right. I was getting a little too heated. So it really, really ended well. And I try to use people in my own lives, because I have a brother and sister who I love dearly. Both of our parents are dead, but they see life politically and spiritually about as 180 degrees difference as you can be. You know, we really don't see eye to eye on, I mean, there are broad things that we agree on, but when it comes down to politics and who they'd like to see in the White House or in Congress or in the Supreme Court, you know, again, 179, 180 degrees, we couldn't be more different. But I try to use those opportunities to create civil conversation where possible. And if it gets heated and emotional, and all of us, this goes back to your original, the question you had just asked me about people holding on to their points, we get into an emotional space where we don't want to let go, because we don't care. It's like, if that person's right, that's going to upset my complete worldview and universal worldview. And I simply can't have that. And that's why sometimes religion has outpaced science and facts in this day and age, because it's more important to believe what we believe rather than maybe to look at facts. But it gives us an opportunity to talk to people who don't believe as we believe. And that's the toughest thing. But I really would say this, and I had a great interview with Mitch Horowitz recently. If you guys haven't seen it, it's on modern occultism. Mitch just dispensed really great wisdom throughout the conversation. But I love what he said. He says he's on social media, part of being an author and a speaker. He said, but I will not engage in trash talk. I just won't do it. I'm not going to, you know, go wrestling in the gutter. And I would say two things. A lot of people say, you know, turn off the news and get rid of your friends that don't believe with you. And I would say no and no. I would say, make sure you get a good news source or three, not just the one you're religiously affiliated with or politically affiliated with. Listen to a few, but not too much, because you can definitely over-diet it on news these days. There's a lot of fear out there. And don't stop talking to people who are different than you politically. At least broach a few things. Try to find some common ground. Always pull the emotion out when you can. And I love this, and maybe it's my background in law that has taught me this. Always ask questions. Always ask questions. You know, if you're an anti-Biden guy, you could ask, rather than say, well, Biden screwed up in Afghanistan or whatever, you'd say, do you think that the Biden administration handled, leaving Afghanistan as well as they could? Or if you're more progressive and you don't like the Republican nominee, Donald Trump, you might ask, well, you know, Liz Cheney says you can choose the Constitution or Donald Trump. Do you agree or disagree with that statement? I mean, I think that there are ways that we can do it and pull the energy out. And again, I wouldn't belabor the point. When my brother comes sometime later this year, we'll probably sit down, because we've always talked politics, even though we've been really, really virulently disagreed. We try not to be disagreeable. And for the most part, we don't go into name calling, because, you know, the love apparently supersedes this. But look, if you went back 280-year cycles ago, 160 years ago, to the Civil War, there were men who graduated West Point. They were in the same class and they loved each other. And yet they went to war against one another. Now, again, I'm not endorsing war. Believe me, I don't want another civil war. I'd love to have what William James called was the moral equivalent of war. And that, I guess, ties back to the story I was sharing about William James a little while ago, is that William James felt that war really in some ways brought out the best in us, because we were most, we had the sharpest mental acuity. You're highly focused. You are totally present. And the person next to you is your brother and comrade, and you're fighting for him or her. So actually war, that crucible of war actually does elevate us in some ways, oddly enough. But what William James was looking for, and what we're all looking for, is what's the moral equivalent of war that can get us through this? What can challenge us in a way, mentally, physically, and spiritually, that we can grow from that and create greater unity in diversity? And I talk about a few things in the book, and I make some suggestions. So again, I'm certainly not for it. I don't think anyone is for, although I hear about American divorce and I hear about American Civil War. That is not an endorsement. It's just, again, I'm not an optimist or a pessimist. I'm a realist. And I look at what's happening, certainly in our nation and really in other places around the world. And I acknowledge the divide. I acknowledge the polarization. I acknowledge the conflict. And to not do so is sticking your head in the sand. I'm just not going to feed into it. And I'm not going to be emotionally contributing to that polarization.
Perhaps what might be perceived as a greater challenge than war is to love each other, respect each other. However, even though when you really look at all of us, we're all really very similar in a lot of ways. We want good food, clean water. We want education for our children. We want to have good relationships. Of course, there might be some of those who, you know, and this is where it gets tricky, who have maybe sociopathic tendencies, shall we say, that can dominate. but a lot of us really want the same things.
Absolutely.
And I also really like what you say about asking questions and doing it in an open, honest way versus an accusatory or derogatory way, and listening to each other.
Yeah. And what you first started saying there, Emmy, how we all want the same things, clean water, good food, peace, security for our family. You're almost quoting word for word a speech that John Kennedy gave at a university graduation in June of 1963, just a few months prior to his death.
So let us not be blind to our differences, but let us also direct attention to our common interests and the means by which those differences can be resolved. And if we cannot end now our differences, at least we can help make the world safe for diversity. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures. And we are all mortal.
Now, just imagine for a moment, you're John Kennedy. You're in the White House, and one of the first things that happens is the Bay of Pigs, the attempt, the CIA, some would call it the deep state, I won't go there today, but the national security state, the CIA and others involved wanted to, and Cuban nationals wanted to take Cuba back. Well, Kennedy was not going to launch a military invasion, but he looked the other way and let the CIA do their thing. Well, it was a failure. Castro was not kicked out of Cuba. All of those Cuban nationals died on the shores of Cuba or taken prisoner. So what happened after that? What happened after that was even greater brinksmanship. Now Russia starts putting nuclear weapons in Cuba. And in October of 1962, the Cuban Missile Crisis puts the world closest to nuclear war than it's ever been. Massive nuclear war. In fact, but for a few hiccups, it could have easily happened. But after getting out of that, Kennedy actually ends up talking to Khrushchev. Now, the Russians pulled their missiles out of Cuba. We pulled some of ours out of Greece and Turkey. They didn't let us know that in the country. But there were certain amounts of people in this country that were so angry at Kennedy, so angry, the mafia, the CIA, Cuban nationals, that they really put a target on his back. And what really pushed them over the edge was Kennedy giving this talk, which mirrored what you just said moments ago, where he was trying to talk to the American people, where he was saying, we all breathe the same air. We all want the same things. We all want peace. We all want to have security. We all want to have a roof over our heads. We want to enjoy the same things. We breathe the same air again. We drink the same water. For most people, that's what they want. But some people, greedy people, people who want power, and those people in at that time in the national security state, and Daniel Sheehan's talked about it here on this channel, they wanted war, they hated communism, and they hated communism so it wasn't just rejecting communism, they hated any nation that had aligned with communism, and they did not want to even create or bridge that gap. Kennedy was suggesting at that time, maybe we might do some things in space with the Russians. Maybe we'll share some information on UFO phenomena with the Russians. In other words, he was trying to create a closeness to an enemy, and between the two of them almost sunk the world into nuclear winter. And when he talked to Khrushchev, Khrushchev basically said to him, you've got guys on your right in your military that you're fighting against. I've got guys on my right in the military that I'm fighting against. Let's find a way to make something work. They created something called the Red Phone, which I actually talk about in the book. Do you know, before the Cuban Missile Crisis, they never had direct contact between the White House and the Kremlin. And after that, it's like, holy cow, we almost destroyed this world and we can't pick up a phone and talk to one another. So what you said is absolutely a human value. And that to me, in some ways, is the greatest human value, realizing our common humanness, right? That's a step up in consciousness. But there are people who do want to divide, people who want power, people who want to see conflict, and people who would like to drag the world down. And they're with us. And maybe they'll always be with us to a certain extent. And maybe that's part of what's going on here in this nation, in this world today. Distrust of the other. racial, religious, again, nationalities. We're seeing great fascism across Europe right now. A lot of nations, Viktor Orban in Hungary, who some people in this nation venerate, or what's going on in Poland. There's even a rise to a small degree right now of a fascist party in Germany, where you'd think that would never happen again. But, you know, again, if these times that we're in now rhyme with the 1930s, we really shouldn't be surprised that we're seeing the rise of fascism again. Fascism or autocracy always rises every so often. It always comes up. It's like the shadow coming up. It's like the darkness that's coming up to the light. What do they say? Who said that, you know, sunlight is the greatest disinfectant? These dark elements in the world, in the American soul, in all of us, that shadow element needs to come to the light, to be exposed for what it is. And we're going through that as an American nation. We still have things in our past that we're unearthing. Sure, we went from slavery, which was god awful, to 100 years of Jim Crow, which was less awful, to 50 to 75 years of systemic racism, which is less awful again, but we're still moving through that. We're still moving through that. And again, I have confidence that we'll be able to move through that, but it is seeing the other person as part of us, as part of the entire movement towards greater unity, greater conscious awareness, and having fun while we're doing it too. Never forget to stop laughing, right?
Yes, grab those opportunities while we can. And I think a lot of people feel the problem is with the other person, the other political party, the other religious affiliation or spiritual practice, or even the other country. Yet, not as often do we look inside of ourselves.
Most of the fourth chapter of my book is dedicated to the other. And there was a great cartoon that came out in the 1960s and actually was the emblem of the first Earth Day. And you're too young to remember this, but there used to be a comic strip called Pogo. He was like a swamp creature. And actually, Walter Kelly, who created this comic strip, had all of these creatures in a swamp. And it was a thin veil of characters in Washington, or how Washington works. But the great phrase that Pogo comes up with is, "I have seen the enemy and he is us." This also came out around the same time that we had been sending astronauts up to the moon and then finally landing on the moon, and then on our way back from the moon, taking pictures of Earth from outer space. And all of a sudden it was like, oh, one world. This is one world. Blue, beautiful pearl spinning in space. And, you know, Freud and Jung talked about the ego. And in more recent decades, there's been a spiritual view of what the ego is as more than just, again, what the early psychiatrists and psychologists alluded to, but the Eckhart Tolles and the Alan Cohns and the Course in Miracles, you know, talk about or refer to the ego as our separate selves. And look, it's important to realize that we all have separate missions. We are inhabiting a separate body. I don't think the ego is bad. I think it's best if my spirit is utilizing the ego in this world as opposed to my ego running the show. Someone once said, you know, the ego is the mail clerk that thought he got kicked up to the president's office. And it is that sense of separation. And again, the Course in Miracles goes into this in great depth, but it is this illusion that we are separate. Now, again, people may think this is some airy fairy new age concept that came up in the 1960s and phooey. Well, you know, it was Ralph Waldo Emerson who said that we are particles of the same whole. We seem to be separate. And then some 70 years later, Albert Einstein said, "We appear to be separate from one another, separate beings in the universe, and that is an optical delusion of consciousness." Think about that. That's what Albert Einstein said, not some flaky New Ager, okay? Uncle Albert said, "It is an optical delusion of consciousness." Well, what was he and some of those other great quantum physicists in the 20th century saying that our separation is an illusion. So the ego has sold us this great story for thousands of years. We're separate. Sure, you and I here, you're in Minnesota, I'm here in Virginia, we're separate, and that, we get that. But ultimately, we are intimately connected and we're one. Again, the human mind or the three-dimensional mind, it almost doesn't make sense. I'm just going to toss it out. Let's go have a beer. But that's why we continue to have war after war, because we create the other. America in the late 20th century, in the 1990s, was again on top of the world. Communism had died. Russia had split up. It was embracing democracy. The Berlin Wall was down. We kind of felt like we had won. But see, here's the thing about the human ego. The human ego always needs an enemy. The human ego always needs the other. And so what happened is that this congressional mediator, he was actually a mediator in Congress. He noticed that after Russia went away, or the Soviet Union went away, that they lost their enemy and we lost ours. Well, who are you going to look to next? Ego's got to find another enemy. There's got to be another enemy somewhere. How about we fight from within? So whether it was going on between Clinton and Newt Gingrich and the contract on America, or contract for America, some people thought it was a contract on America, but that split that happened in the 1990s has now matured in such a way that we see what the individual ego mind can do. And that is always creating an enemy. And what this mediator said was, I saw that split in the 1990s, and I saw that now those chickens had come home to roost. In the past, it was the Soviet Union, it was communism. Once that went away, the ego still needed to find an enemy. And so it went within. Now, one of the things I do suggest in my book, since we are looking for an other, even though that other is, in a sense, an illusion, some of the things that we are facing with right now may be the substitute for that other. And maybe it might be what William James talked about being the moral equivalent of war. And one of those things, in my mind, is the climate crisis that we're facing. So this is something really born of ourselves, mostly, probably. It might be cyclical. Some people have said there's some historical cyclical nature to it, but let's not kid ourselves. Humanity has dumped a lot of stuff on Mother Earth.
Or the dinosaurs deemed it so.
Hadn't heard that one yet. Perhaps climate change, something that we, again, has been born of mostly or largely or certainly significantly our own contribution, we have created an ersatz enemy. So, I've got to go back to this because, you know, I'll tell the story of my dad. Now, my dad was a World War II vet, okay? Chemical engineer, perfectly left brain guy, can do, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, not a hint of metaphysics in his entire body. We're driving out to our summer home in Long Island one year. And we're having, and even at that age, I was a little, you know, history wonk, even at this young, precious age. And we started talking about some of these things. And he said, you know, the only way that the Soviet Union and America is ever going to get it together is if we're attacked from outer space. Now, this was my dad. Again, this wasn't some woke, pinko, new age waif standing on a corner in San Francisco. This was my military vet, chemical engineer, left brain father talking about these kinds of things. But again, coming out of the 60s, 50s, 60s, and early 70s, having programming dealing with, you know, aliens and threats from outer space, we didn't realize maybe how real aliens and UFOs were at the time, because it was still part of science fiction, and we relied too probably about Roswell, that my father and lots of other well-meaning vets at that time said, hey, look, the only way you're going to create unity is you got to have a common enemy. That's basically what he was saying, more or less. But the common enemy we have created today, if you will, is climate change. It is a war, quote unquote, that must be fought, not against an other, but by something that has been created by, largely has been created by humankind. And if that's the case, it's something that we need to marshal our forces and act on. You know, the fights going on in the world between nations, you know, United States and China, United States and Russia, what's going on in our own nation, left versus right, blue versus red, it reminds me of two drunken guys fighting each other in a burning house. And, you know, they're not thinking because they're drunk and they're fighting. Think of a drunk father and a young buck son, and they're fighting and they see that there's fire upstairs in the house, but I gotta beat this guy up first. You know, my pride's on the line. I've gotta get the next shot in. And the house is literally burning down. And what will it take? I don't know if they can drink a pot of coffee or what's going to make them sober up and stop fighting and realize that the greater threat, if you will, is coming from something that, and again, I use climate here as the example. When are we going to marshal our forces to deal with a greater enemy, even though it's not an enemy per se? It's an ersatz enemy, if you will. The other things that I find could compellingly bring us together might be what would happen if two or three atomic bombs went off somewhere, not the start of a war, but an accident, creating not a nuclear winter, but could impact our climate further. Would younger generations say, push these old guys out of here because they are just creating division? Maybe that's the moral equivalent of war. Again, interviewing Mitch Horowitz recently, he said, bipartisanship seems to be a very quaint term in this day and age. He said, but the one area that I'm finding agreement on, and I was thinking the same thing. I was just going to ask him this question as he was answering it. The one place of common interest in bipartisanship is the whole notion of UFO, UAP phenomena. Doesn't seem to be much of a political, you know, football going on there. People on both the left and right. So if there would be disclosure, if there would be some sort of contact, what might that do to bring the race together? You know, what might that be the moral equivalent of war? So I don't know the answer to that. All I know is that we are facing an existential crisis on many levels, and it's going to take something higher than the way we've been thinking. And again, the famous Einstein quote, you know, we're going to have to come up with a consciousness that's greater than the consciousness that has created this existential crisis. And it kind of forces us in a way. It's pushing us as well. We're being pulled by the vision of what this world can be, and we're being pushed by the existential crisis. But when I say pushed, it must be done in a way of equanimity, of balance. I mean, look, I believe people should be politically involved and politically motivated. I'm not one of these kinds of people who says, you know, turn in, turn on, drop out. Don't drop out. What would Tim Leary's life have been if he said, you know, turn on, tune in, serve mankind? But I don't tell people to stop watching the news. Watch the news. No, get involved in something. Serve your community locally. Get on city council. Listen to your so-called enemy. Be involved in it, but do it from a place of great equanimity. You know, I started out by saying Thomas Jefferson said that every generation in American history, the tree of liberty needs to be watered by the blood of those patriots. And one scholar on Jefferson said, I wonder if Jefferson would have said the same thing if he had had the knowledge or awareness of the Thoreaus, Gandhis, and Martin Luther Kings, peaceful revolutionaries. I mean, I think Mother Teresa said it best. She said, don't ask me to an anti-war rally. I'll go to a pro-peace rally. I'm not going to be against something. I'll be for something. So the Martin Luther Kings and the Gandhis of the 20th century showed us how to be revolutionaries, but to be peaceful, conscious revolutionaries. And look, it wasn't always pretty. Gandhi's people got beaten up. Martin Luther King's people got cannonaded by water and attacked by dogs. We know that it wasn't pretty. But, and MLK, and both Gandhi and MLK, by the way, you know, great progressives gave up their lives to assassins. But at the same time, they left us with a great gift, and that is to be active in the world, to be at a place where you're at most centered in the world. You know, we talk a lot about mysticism on this channel. Emmy, you and I have talked about it. We've interviewed people who are mystically oriented. And I would say that, you know, mysticism is one of those most overused of words. I write about this in the book as well. It has been adopted, castigated, ridiculed, laughed at, etc. But the mysticism of many people of various religious stripes or none at all. These were people who realized the oneness of one another, of the Godhead. But the mystics that I write about are also the most pragmatic of people because they took what they got from their inner journey and then they went out and they acted. So some of the greatest people in American history, whether it was Emerson or Thoreau or William James, Pierre Chardin, you know, people who had great mystical experiences, Thomas Merton, the great Catholic mystic of the 1950s and 60s. These were people who didn't stay home. Now, there's nothing wrong with a mystic going up to the Himalayas and sitting in, you know, quiet meditation and raising the entire vibrational level of the planet. I'm all for that. That's great. But most of us need to be mystics outside of monasteries. We need to be delving into the deepest well of consciousness within each of us, touching that part of the divine, and then taking it out in action. And I honestly believe that the time period we're in right now, no one's going to be able to sit on the sidelines. Everything is going to call us forward. Our presence needs to be keen and focused and loving, but it needs to be present and it needs to be in the game. What happened at the time of the Second World War, when the fascists in Germany were gearing up, they were a very, very strong force. And Albert Einstein, who had to leave Germany because he was a Jew, and thank God they were kicking Jews out, because if Einstein had stayed in Germany, maybe they would have gotten the bomb before us. But Einstein said, organizational force must be met by organizational force. And I think what that says is not that if somebody's got a gun that you're going to take out a gun as well. I don't think that that's what it's referring to. But I think it's talking about organization. It's talking about focus. It's talking about joining forces. And it's talking about moving forward and being heard. And being heard is absolutely essential. If people think that they're going to be able to sit on the sidelines, sit this one out, take a look at their, just keep looking at their 401k and taking trips around the world and evading.
And their smartphones.
Issues. And there's, and just looking down, right, the whole time. I think we're sadly mistaken if that's the case, because I think these times are calling for participation, calling us out to be our authentic selves, being, as Jeffrey loves to say on the channel, you know, being the best authentic selves that we can possibly be, but being counted and being heard and not being afraid to speak up.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit more about the mystical aspect of this conversation. As you're talking, one of the enemies, if you will, is that when you raised climate change, many people are actually feeling quite fearful, despondent even, apathetic. People are more stressed than ever. People have high levels of anxiety. Children are having a hard time attending school. The teachers are having a hard time, not in all places, but in certain cases, having a hard time managing their own stress, let alone dealing with the child who was just bullied. And it's going up all the way even to the college level, as far as schools. So how can we inspire people to stay engaged and be a part of how we can all make this a better world, really, when many just feel like they want to give up, and some actually do, and leave the planet?
Well, that's always their choice if they want to leave the planet. I don't think there are any shortcuts in the universal scheme. Again, I didn't make the rules at the beginning, unless maybe I did with y'all, you know. But the whole notion of suicide, I think, just, you know, unfortunately, just shortcuts. You know, there's no free lunch. You're not gonna you can't just bow out. Maybe you can from this particular lifetime, but I think at some point in time, you have to meet yourself. You know, the short answer is get off your phone and help people. I mean, look, all of us get into self-pity from time to time. We all get over, you did just an amazing program recently, you know, discussing anxiety and stress. And certainly I think I would agree with your guest.
Dr. David H. Rosmarin.
Yes. Thank you. Great insights. And I would also concur that we live in a much faster paced society, a lot of electronics, a lot of expectations, et cetera. And so we have created greater stress and anxiety for ourselves. And when he said that 100 million subscriptions are dispensed a year in the United States for anti-anxiety drugs like, Valium and Clonopin and, or Clonopin, that would, you know, I'm not entirely shocked by that. It saddens me, but I think part of it is, you know, we've siloed and, you know, as wonderful as our phones are, and again, is fire good or bad? Well, it depends on how you use it. Same thing with our phones. It can be a magical, you know, device, but it's also, and especially in younger generations, it's also created silos and separation and fear of missing out and competition. And so the best way sometimes is put the phone down, look for somebody who's going through something worse than you right now. And you're always going to find somebody. I'm talking to myself too. Believe me, this is not, I ain't preaching. I ain't no preacher. This is about, you know, when we take our view off of ourself, that's when we move forward. You know, I tell a little story in the book about Norman Vincent Peale, who wrote, you know, The Power of Positive Thinking. And of course, he's seen as this great, you know, Christian author. And yet his influence was really New Thought and Transcendentalism. And he was influenced by Ernest Holmes, who started Religious Science and then what has become Centers for Spiritual Living. And when Norman Vincent Peale was a young cub reporter in Detroit, he was always in a place of fear. He was messing up, and his boss came to him and he handed him a book. He goes, "If you're in a place of fear, you're thinking of self. You're dwelling in self. You're thinking of self. You're focused on self. Stop thinking of yourself." And he shoved a book in his face, and it was a book by Ernest Holmes, who again started Science of Mind. Now we know the name Norman Vincent Peale much better today than people who know Ernest Holmes, because The Power of Positive Thinking, I think, sold over, you know, 100 million books worldwide, you know, over time period. Ernest Holmes is, you know, a little asterisk in the history of American spirituality. And yet to me, he's a pillar. He's a pillar of New Thought. That was a term that William James came up with and again has influenced American thinking, even to this day, even though we don't know it sometimes. So stop thinking of self is what Ernest Holmes would say.
The main theme of your book is about a convergence of mysticism, religion, atheism, and science. So how can we find that unity when each group, if you will, feels that they have the answer?
Well, you know, I think one of the things is this. I'll give you a good example of, you know, you're right. People are in various silos thinking they have the answer. But when you know, it's like living in a city sometimes. You know, maybe you didn't know a gay person. Maybe you didn't know a black person. Maybe you didn't know a transgender person. All of a sudden, they're your next door neighbor. Or maybe they're in your church. Or maybe they've come to a city council meeting. And then you realize, well, they don't look that foreign. And that's why sometimes in places where there's a lot of population, people get to see lots of different creeds, national, something different than you. And so it's the same thing now. I mean, you know, if people are talking about mysticism, others may not believe that there is such a thing, but if they're listening to you at all, now at least they're like Benjamin Franklin. He at least got exposed to it, and he realized that the person talking about it wasn't crazy. A really good example is what I bring up in the seventh chapter of my book, God/Not God, you know, consciousness and science. You know, the big and Jeff's talked about it a billion times here in his career and on this network, that there has been an ongoing friction between scientific materialism and those who believe that, you know, the expansion of awareness or consciousness, esotericism, psi phenomena, etc. I mean, Jeff was out there on the battlegrounds, on the frontiers decades ago talking about psi phenomena when 95% of the people just knew that that was nuts. Nowadays, less people think so because they've been exposed to things that suggest consciousness is not relegated to the brain. That maybe when the brain dies and the body dies, consciousness does not end. I look at the work right up the road here from where I am in Virginia, about 3 hours north, 2.5 hours north of here, University of Virginia. The work that they're doing at UVA's DOPS program, the Division of Perceptual Studies. Their scientific research, and yes, it's analysis and research, and I'm going to call it science, into people's near-death experiences and past lives. Now, all of a sudden, if you're a religious fundamentalist, let's say you're a Christian fundamentalist, and you start watching stories of other Christian fundamentalists who had a kid who had a reincarnation experience that just knocked your socks off. And again, I think one of the best documentaries on this or programming on this, if you go to Netflix and you watch the six-part series, Surviving Death, the first and sixth episodes of that series really focus on the work that's being done at UVA's DOPS program, which has been done, by the way, since Ian Stevenson was doing it back in the 1950s, collecting reincarnation stories. All of a sudden, if you're a Christian, you love Jesus, but you say, well, reincarnation is just for the occultists. Now you start saying, well, wait a minute, maybe there's something else here. And maybe you're an atheist or a scientific materialist. And you find out, wow, this four-year-old kid or this six-year-old kid just had a past life memory, which is so searing, that has been studied and analyzed, and as far as UVA goes, has been, the file is closed because it's been determined to be accurate. 1,700 of the 2,500 cases that UVA has in the DOPS program have been, to their satisfaction, been determined. All of a sudden, can you really be a scientific materialist fundamentalist? Can you be a Christian fundamentalist? I mean, at some point in time, you've got to say there might be some credence, even if you don't believe it. You know, you might be questioning your own beliefs, which is perfect. I think any, you know, spiritual group that anyone goes to, you don't go there to get your questions answered. You go there to get your answers questioned. There's always more. And one of the great modern mystics today, Richard Rohr, who's with the Center for Action and Contemplation in New Mexico, not too far from where Jeff lives. Here are Catholic priests and lay people who honestly, I think 50 or 60 years ago would have been kicked out of the church. But they have been talking about the continuation of consciousness, the commonality among other religions. And Richard Rohr, I think, says it best. He says, if you really want to move up in consciousness, he says you have to reach a place of doubt. At some point in time in your lifetime, you have to doubt what you believe and what you've been given as your belief. He said, if you don't, you can move up within that one chapter or that one group. He said, but if you want to get outside and go to the next level, you've got to go to a place of doubt. And in my own life, I look at that time coming out of college where, yes, I had engaged in hallucinogens and I started meditating. I was raised a Catholic. And then for a short period of time, I just didn't believe there was a God. I just didn't believe there was something like that. Or maybe what I was rejecting was the, you know, the orthodox two-dimensional God that I had been more or less raised with. Not that my parents were fundamentalists and not that my Catholic church was a bad place. It just wasn't a whole lot of juice there. Follow the Ten Commandments, do this, genuflect, sign of the cross, you're good. There had to be more to it than that. And so in order to move in consciousness, we need to have a time of doubt and get to that next level. And that's what I write about extensively in the book too. We all need to doubt those belief systems we were given and that we've come to believe as being eminently true. I don't know about you, but 5 or 10 years from now, you know, I might think differently. I might. This is always what the founders said, you know, reserve the right to change your mind. And again, that's why I bring up the journalist S.E. Cupp in my book. The atheist is a true blue atheist, but said, I don't know, maybe 30, 40 years from now, I might change my mind.
And that's really having an open mind. And maybe all of these attachments to viewpoints are really just labels or experiences we're all having in sort of the stream of oneness. You know, at the end of the beginning, middle and end of the day, we're all just having experiences, and really our own experiences growing up, our inner and outer experiences, our conditionings, what we read, who we spend time with, the inputs we have all really determine, as you say, what we believe. You brought up near-death experiences and reincarnation, and I believe it was Dean Radin who, and probably others who have conducted research, where he said that many of these people are having these types of experiences, but it isn't until somebody has an experience that's maybe outside of what they had believed previously for them to really have a change in perspective.
Yeah. And it can go either way. It's funny. I've been asked, and I'm going to try to interview Susan Blackmore, who I write about in my book. Again, the chapter dealing with consciousness, because here is a woman who is a Buddhist meditator, had a near-death experience, and at one time thought it was all bunk, and wrote several books with forewords by the atheist Richard Dawkins, scientist Richard Dawkins. Clearly, quote unquote, in that camp of you know, the dying brain theory, and you know, anything supernatural is hokum. And she still doesn't believe in supernaturalism, if you will. She's written a tome on consciousness, but she has also said, I don't believe that religion is a toxin. She changed her stance on that. She said, I never thought that the dying brain theory could be proven. It can't be. So you see, when people start interacting with these camps, especially in the realm of consciousness, where some people have some really definitive ideas, and damn it, I'm right. You start talking to other people who are intelligent, open-hearted, open-minded, and even if you don't agree with them, there's just something that allows you to open up further. And I kind of end the book with the necessity of looking at our own shadow. If we don't do our shadow work, forget it. It's going to come at us. So, and I basically look at three different groups towards the end of the book: Christian fundamentalists. Because look, we're dealing with Christian nationalism today. It's a fact, my humble opinion. One presidential candidate is now offering Bibles with constitutions and the Declaration of Independence bound together. Because obviously, you know, one side owns all three of those, right? But if you're a New Age, New Thought person, there's a lot that can be said for that, but there's a shadow side to that too. And the shadow side can be found in, for example, my own critique of New Age, New Thought is that when the 20th century opened up, the so-called New Thought movement that had also been very socially active started splitting off into New Age, and New Age was all about, you know, self-improvement. Nothing wrong with that. Feathering one's life with greater peace and greater prosperity. Nothing wrong with that, but also becoming very insular. As opposed to the evangelicals, and that's where the shadow side comes in, looking at evangelicals who, when they were on the outs in the 1950s and 60s, rather than cowering and going inward, they decided to run for city council. They decided to run for mayor. They decided to run for school boards. They ran, become the, you know, the proverbial dog catcher of the town. They got involved. And people may rue the fact or may dislike Christian fundamentalism because it has led to Christian nationalism, but it is part of that shadow element that I think that, you know, New Age, New Thought can learn from, is becoming more congealed, becoming more focused, taking action, being involved in the world, taking your spiritual journey and going out and doing something about it. It's the same thing with atheism. And again, I would just recommend to people, if they get a chance, it's only a few pages long, but it's towards the end of the book, where each of these groups can learn from one another if they delve deeply enough into the shadow work of their own belief systems. So that's something we can always do. Look, we're on the planet for a reason, right? I mean, if we believe, and if you and I, Emmy and Jeff and many of those people who are on this network or on this channel, believe that we're eternal beings, that there is something to our spiritual nature, that we're far more than our corporeal being that is living in Minnesota and Virginia at the time, that we're obviously encased in this three-dimensional experience for some reason. I've got to figure. You know, there's got to be a reason for me to grow, to expand and learn. And maybe even by being restricted, if you will, because every near-death experience I've ever heard of is that once they get outside the body, it's like, hell no, I'm not going back. This is way too freeing. Well, you got a few things you've got to do. Or, hey, I want to go back because there's still something I've got to finish up. So there's obviously something in the soul's journey that says coming to this place is going to do something for the overall growth and awareness and expansion of your soul. So even though sometimes it feels like hell, and let's face it, sometimes it does, there's stress, there's anxiety, there are all the things we have to deal with, that ultimately when we realize that we're part of a greater scheme and we're here for a purpose and that purpose is eternal, it makes it a little easier all of a sudden there's meaning behind what you're going through in a daily life. You stub your toe or somebody ticks you off or something like that. It's just all part of the continuum.
Yeah. And in those near-death experiences, people, is it about, what, 30% of the people have life reviews? And yes. They describe how when they have that life review, they experience it from the people they were engaged with and have all the felt experiences and thoughts and emotions. So we really are interconnected in that way.
Unbelievably so. I've known about Raymond Moody and near-death experiences now for decades, but it's only been maybe in the last 7 or 8 years, which I really took a deep dive into the life review, where, yes, I had a recent interview with Dr. Bruce Grayson at University of Virginia's DOPS program. And I didn't know it was this number, but he said, yeah, Chris, about 30% of the studies of the near-death experiences that we see, these people have the life review. And again, there's a great movie done on this called Defending Your Life with Albert Brooks. I heartily recommend it. And there are other ones as well. But you're absolutely right. Imagine not only feeling the feelings that you experience at that moment in that interaction with that other person, but that simultaneously you get to feel the feelings of the emotions and the thoughts of that person that you were interacting with. And let's say you're having an argument. Now all of a sudden you're feeling your pulse go up. You're feeling your temperature go up. And at the same time, you're feeling the fear of the other person and the belittling of the other person. Bruce Grayson shared an amazing story of one of his patients who went through a near-death experience and then a life review. Being able to see, as he said, you know, being able to see, count the number of mosquitoes around your head and to know what the temperature was and to know the numbers of every license plate that passed you in the moment, to have that kind of acuity. And yet, more importantly, to feel the feelings of that other person, which obviously, as I think you just stated a moment ago, underscores our essential oneness.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no judgment in these life reviews. You know, bad person, you're going to hell, or going to purgatory. You know, turn around, I've got this cat of nine tails I'm going to use on your back. Here's a demon for you. None of that. Just like here it is. And if anything, we judge ourselves, you know, or maybe there's some remorse or what have you, but it's a reminder to the soul to change it up, to learn from the experience. And that's some of the things that we're going through right now.
And to be kinder to each other and ourselves and help each other, because we all can use all the help we can get in this lifetime.
Absolutely. And being kind to ourselves, you know, to some people that sounds almost selfish, but it's not about indulging ourselves. It's about forgiving ourselves. It's about not judging ourselves. So it's really about, I want to use the word monitoring, but being watchful of the thoughts we think about ourselves.
Awareness.
It's always telling us. Yeah. Yeah. Awareness.
And it makes me think of the work of Lynn McTaggart, who wrote a book, The Power of Eight, and how she brought groups together to positively impact people with thoughts, with consciousness. And one of the effects that she didn't know would happen is that many people started reporting a mirror effect, where they started having maybe a significant health concern all of a sudden improve, relationships that were tumultuous smooth out, financial situations that looked incredibly dire improve as well. And so I think that that's that tendency we all have to, or many of us have, I should say, where we want to help others. We kind of have this instinct. I mean, there's even stories of people risking their lives to help other people, because they really, at a deep core, we sense that we do have this oneness.
Yeah, this altruism. I don't know if you heard the story about the recent, not that long ago, the bridge that collapsed in Baltimore, where a policeman, you know, he found out, you know, that this ship had lost control, and he was getting in his car. He knew there was only a matter of seconds, but he knew that there were still guys out on that bridge that were working on potholes. They had cut off the traffic. And he got in his car and he was going to speed out there and risk his life.
Wow.
Risk his life. And that's when the bridge collapsed.
Oh my gosh.
But think about that. The man, and this, again, even goes back to what William James was saying. We need to find a moral equivalent of war, because in war, you kind of find or sense or experience that selflessness. It's not about me anymore. It's about the team. It's about my buddy in the foxhole with me. And I'm ready to risk my life for it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Isn't that one of the greatest commandments of all?
Right. And maybe it isn't that we so much need war every 80 years, but maybe we need some type of great challenge. And like you say, maybe it is like Danny Sheehan said on the live stream we had here on New Thinking Aloud with me, you, and Jeffrey Mishlove, that this really can bring a lot of us together, as well as wanting to take care of our planet as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. These are things that it's an existential crisis in and of itself. And the metaphor is, you know, it's of our own doing. There is no separation between ourselves and that event. Just as there's really no separation even between two warring armies, that one might be wearing blue, the other one might be wearing red, but it's an illusion. Albert Einstein, once again, an optical delusion of consciousness. And again, I understand, as we're all trying to make our way and create our own lives that are so wonderful. And again, we've all been given separate charges. We are individual souls. No one's doubting that. But in some ways, I think wisdom is carrying both of what appear to be counterbalancing realities within our heart, and knowing that both are true at the same time, even though they seem to be completely in opposite.
When we were preparing for this interview, Christopher, we discovered that we were both raised Catholic. However, in your journey, you were taught that there are many paths up the mountain to that oneness of which we're all a part. And in my experience, I grew up going to the St. Paul Cathedral, which is a glorious building. Mm-hmm. And the only time I really felt a connection in those services was when we would say, "Peace be with you," and we would shake each other's hands and look into each other's eyes. I could almost even cry talking about it right now. It was so beautiful. Or when we would say the Lord's Prayer, which is a very unifying prayer, in my opinion. But since my parents divorced, which was a blessing from the divorce, right? There's challenges, but there's something good that can come from that, is that I was able to recognize there are many paths to this oneness of which we're all a part. And so it brings us back to the word of mysticism and how we can have a polarization of the inner and the outer, right? The mystical journey is going within. And some people are looking for a strong leader on the outside. So how do we balance that journey of going within when some people are empowering sometimes leaders who don't always have everybody's best interest at heart? How do we find that unity with those seemingly opposing experiences?
Well, again, I think, and thankfully, I think in this day and age that we're living in, the fastest growing religious group are the spiritual but not religious. So the benefit there is that people are finding a path. You know, Jefferson once said, "I am a religion of one," a deist who loved Unitarianism. And I think that it is natural for us to seek the transcendent, you know, within each of us. As I mentioned before, I think the greatest mystics of all, those people who took that deep inner journey, and which, by the way, is not always the easiest of journeys. I talk about Dorothy Day in my book. I talk about Meister Eckhart in my book. I talk about Pierre Chardin. All of these people went through moments of doubt, moments of ridicule, etc. But they kept keeping on. And they never backed away from being in the world. And again, if I can impart anything today, for anyone there who is moving down their spiritual path of greater awareness, greater love, greater meaning in one's life, however that looks, that whatever it is we do, that consciousness needs to be brought into the stream of interactivity and interconnectedness in our societies. That means showing up. And it also means not denigrating someone because they say something denigrating to you, or someone that even holds fascistic ideas. Now, as I said earlier on, I think America is going through a time period and it could lapse into fascism, autocracy. I alone can fix it. We've been coming down that, you know, we've been flirting with the notion of a unitary executive in this country now for the last 30 or 40 years. Again, constitutionally, you know, that's part of my background, Emmy. We've looked at according more powers to the executive, to the president. That was never really the notion of our founders. There were three separate equal branches of government, but there has been a movement, what is called an originalist movement, which we find in our Supreme Court today and in some of our Supreme Court cases and in some people who look at our government giving lots of power to one person. But I would say when someone comes along and says, I alone can fix it, as Mussolini did in the 1920s and others say, run the other way. Be very, very aware of that, because as soon as you hear that, we're looking at autocracy, we're looking at the strongman, and that never ends well. And again, I think that even if that does raise its head here in America, that's not part of the American DNA. We kicked the king out because we didn't believe in an autocrat. And even though we are tending more towards autocracy, and again, in an age of greater conflict and chaos, that's when people do seem to jettison their own wherewithal of who they are and are willing to give it up to the strongman. But the antidote to that really is spiritual questing. It's interesting. There's a journal called the Journal for the Scientific Study of Religion that's been around for 7, 8, 9, 10 decades. I can't, maybe 80, 90 years. And after the Second World War, they really examined, now, how did fascism come about? I mean, you had a lot of religious people in that world, in Germany and in Italy in those times. You know, you had Shinto Buddhists in Japan. How did that autocracy take over? And the story of Benito Mussolini, to me, is the most telling one. Again, he is the man who really was the quintessential fascist of the 1920s and 30s. He preceded Hitler. Hitler really could not have come to power without Mussolini coming to power first. And Mussolini was an atheist. He was an anti-cleric. He hated Catholicism. Until it dawned on him, the only way he was going to rise to power was if he worked in tandem or worked in sync with the consciousness of the nation at the time. And where did he find his greatest adherents? He found them in church. How so? Because at that time, the strength of the Catholic Church and the orthodoxy in Catholicism was that you made a central authority or figure, that there was an obedience to authority, that there was one inerrant set of beliefs, and that there was mistrust of the outsider. Well, this is perfectly what fascism was. A centralized power figure, obedience to authority, belief in one inerrant set of political beliefs, and mistrust of the outsider outside the party. So Mussolini gets married in the church, has his kids Christian in the church, and when he's talking to the Italian people, he tells them that the road of values in Italy goes through the Vatican, and people fell behind him. Now, I'm not blaming all religions and all religious experiences, but the Journal for the Scientific Study of Religion makes it very clear. Where there are orthodoxies involved, and especially exceedingly conservative orthodoxies, where if you cross those rules, you might go to hell, you might get punished. So there are very authoritarian aspects to almost all religions. In Buddhism, some people are drawn to the meditation teacher who whacks them if they squirm around while they're meditating. There are some in the Jewish religion that believe that, Judaism has a right to all of the Middle East, or they believe in a caste system of sorts. In Catholicism, you're going to go to hell if you don't believe in what the Council of Nicaea came forth with 1700 years ago. So there's always that kind of authoritarianism, and it can be found in religion. But the one escape hatch, according to the Journal Scientific Study of Religion, is spiritual questing, which means you question the religion that you were raised with. You look at other religions. You look at other spiritual beliefs. You pick up practices that are outside your own mainstream orthodox religion that you were raised in. And by creating that kind of diversity, your mind breaks free of an authoritarian or autocratic belief system. But right now, we're seeing the rise of Christian nationalism, not only in this country, but I think around the world. I think it's very dangerous. Lewis Sinclair was purportedly said, although I don't think he ever said it, you know, when fascism comes to America, it'll be holding a Bible and will be wrapped in the flag. Now, whether he said it or not, I don't know. But much like the Mark Twain quote I used early on in our conversation, I think it bears some belief. Religion loses something when it becomes political, and the political order loses something when it becomes religious. And now we're seeing the fusing of that in some quarters. And if it does come to pass, and if it does take root in this country, holding the levers of power of all three branches of government, then I think, yes, we are in for a darker period. I'm not going to mince words here. If that takes place, the challenge will be even greater than it is now. So keep your eyes and ears open. Not that it's to be feared, but it means it's going, any of these things are going to call us forward to greater presence and greater participation in our communities, in the political process, in the cultural process that we're facing today.
In your book, you describe how the Native Americans influenced the, quote, founding fathers, although they're, of course, founding mothers that we don't hear much about.
Right.
Do you think that what happened with the Native Americans in this country and other countries is somehow echoing forward in time? And do you think that some of the polarization we're experiencing could be quelled with some type of healing of what happened in the past?
I truly do believe that that is one of the marks on the American soul. We say that America's greatest sin is slavery. Well, maybe the earliest greatest sin is what happened to Native Americans and how they were basically exonerated, how they were pushed out, how they were massacred, how they were given alcohol and to dull their senses and making very bad trade agreements, and then eventually pushing them across the country and then sticking them on reservations and even putting them on reservations with other Indians of different tribes that they historically hated. So that is a great stain on the American soul. And it, look, I don't think guilt ever helps anything, and no one's asking America to be guilty. I think all people are asking for is to be aware of the fact that these things have happened in our country and could happen to you or I if we're part of some sort of minority. Someone once said, and I produced a program some 25 years ago, and I wish I had the person who said this, but that America will really never realize its full spiritual awareness and destiny, unity and diversity, until it comes to terms with what happened with the American Indians and its inclusion in the American soul. And again, the best book I've heard on this, I've mentioned it already in this interview, Original Politics, Making America Sacred Again by Glenn Aparicio Parry, who's actually been interviewed on this channel. I got his book before I ever heard him on this channel. But he talks about that being really part of the American soul and part of, and again, let's be very clear. Native Americans did not live completely in peace and in peace with one another, nor were they, you know, the very best environmentalists ever seen. But I can tell you this, there was less war. There was greater understanding. There was certainly greater empowerment of women. Women held the talking stick. Mostly the councils were circular and women always were part of that. Now, until the patriarchal society, which I think we're moving away from patriarchalism in this country and around the world, because it's just time. And we're also seeing that the male sector of each of us, not just me in a male body, you in a female body, but, you know, eschewing the balance between male and female has gotten so out of whack that the feminine principle is rising again. I personally believe that that's what 2012 was all about. And, the rift in the Milky Way, which was symbolic of feminism, without going into too much details, is a signet or sign for our age that it's time for a more feminine civilization to arise again. And yes, that's part of the Native American culture. And that Native American culture and its belief system and veneration for the earth and veneration for spirit, not encased in a one god, male, shall I say, white with a beard figure, but the great spirit, which may be more akin to a pantheism of sorts. But that is an integral part of the American soul. And again, this is exactly what Jacob Needleman talks about in his book, The American Soul, what a vital part that plays. But if America is going to get it right and is going to be a leader again in enlightenment and consciousness and conscience, then it needs to come to grips with its own shadow, which deals with African American, which deals with gender issues, which deals with the Native American. When all men and women are truly treated equally, then we start living those values that are deep, deep within the American soul. And again, I'm confident that that will come to pass. I really do believe that. I don't think this world is going to end. I think the world will be here. Gaia will be here. Whether we're here or not is a question. But I think we do get through this one way, shape, or form. And it's because of those great ideals that are manifested in greater form. And again, it doesn't mean it's, and even the people who wrote the Constitution, even the people who founded our nation knew that they weren't living those principles. Some of them were slave owners. We know that. But they threw a grappling hook out to the future and they dared America to pull it into their present, even though they themselves knew that they were not up to it at that point. They knew that it was an ideal to live up to and that we could eventually get there. And I think step by step, you know, slowly, almost imperceptibly over time, we're getting there. But sometimes it seems like we're going backwards.
Yes, we often think of it in terms as men and women, but there's also the qualities of femininity and masculinity, and perhaps bringing in more of a balance of cooperation than competition may also be vital at this time.
Yeah, and that's again where the feminine principle comes to the fore. I mean, but think about some of the greatest icons in American history, from the Statue of Liberty to Columbia. There are those great icons and memes that remind us of the feminine side. It's interesting that even Catholicism, you know, the religion that you and I were raised in.
Yeah.
I wish I'd been introduced to the mystics earlier.
Yeah,
on.
Me
I might
too.
Have had a different view of the Catholic mystics like Meister Eckhart and Thomas Merton, Pierre Chardin earlier on. I might have stuck with my Catholicism. But Catholicism really had a great veneration for the feminine. You know, the Virgin Mary, not quite up to Jesus, you know, on the level, but she's getting there, or she's close by.
Yeah.
I mean, in the Catholic belief system, you know, it's not only Jesus that that ascended into heaven. You know, Mary's got her date too.
Yeah.
The assumption is about her, being without stain. I look at that as a sense of purity, purity of consciousness. But yeah, I think we are at that point in time in history where the feminine principle is now getting an equal seat at the table. And it may just be one of those revolutions in civilizations, you know, that there had been a time of feminine or female civilizations in ancient past and in other cultures. But certainly in Western civilization, that has not been the case for thousands of years. But I think we're ready to make a change. I think we will see a female president within our lifetimes. I think we are now seeing more women in Congress than we've ever seen before. And that has been, you look at the trajectory of women, and that's one of the, I just want to mention this too. This is one of the key points that I raise in my book. Whether it's African Americans, Native Americans, or women, I talk about those who are furthest from the levers of power and how they contributed and helped shape the American soul. And so there are a lot of female characters in the book who played a role that maybe you never heard of. Maybe you've never heard of Rebecca Cox Jackson, or perhaps you never heard of Dorothy Day, or knew about Gertrude Stein and how she contributed to metaphysics. I mean, there are a lot of female persons in my book that talk about how they contributed to the soul of America, Louisa May Alcott and others in the Transcendentalist movement. this is part and parcel. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, I bring her up in the book too, how she divorced her one. Well, some of them divorced their husbands because they didn't want them to get educated. Elizabeth Cady Stanton made sure that she did not use the words obey when she got married and that she kept her name. So we are seeing those seeds, you know, the shoulders that we all stand upon, but especially women. You stand upon the shoulders of people who have been strong and at times did not have the power. I mean, many people don't realize that after black men got the right to vote in 1870, it took women another 50 years to get the right to vote in this country. You know, I've often given little quizzes when I give talks at my Unity Life, a Spiritual Life Center. You know, who got the right to vote first? And most people do understand, oh, well, you know, it was black men before women, but the fact that they had to wait another 50 years. But those things are all changing. And thank God for that. And that's going to play a big role too. And in fact, even in elections, one of the big roles, how do women vote? Where do they vote? Why do they vote? You know, the abortion issue being such a big issue impacting women, that's going to figure into politics. Women of all colors and all stripes, if you will, are coming to the fore in power in Congress, in places of leadership all around the world.
Mm-hmm.
That's changing. And again, thank God, better late than never.
I also want to highlight how your book is about America, and we've certainly talked a lot about America, but what you mention is that the United States has some of the most diversity in any country of the world. And so you're offering that if we can come together with all this diversity, and maybe even some of that diversity is helpful in the process, that can also set the tone for other nations.
Well, you know, this the notion of American exceptionalism gets twisted sometimes, that we're better than the world, and clearly we're not. There are lots of things about America. And again, we as Americans can sometimes have a jaundiced or narrow or myopic perspective of who we are. I think what everyone can agree on is that when the New World was established, that at least Western civilization coming to this nation, including Native Americans here and African American slaves, that it was, you know, a test tube. It was an experiment. You know, can people of diverse colors, religions, genders, creeds, you know, live under one umbrella in relative peace? Can a constitutionally limited democratic republic outlive the autocracies and the kingdoms of other races? And not that it's better than, it's just happens to be scientific fact or historical fact that these various elements of humanity came to live here. And, you know, look, obviously I'm biased. If America goes down and becomes fascistic, it doesn't mean the entire world will, but it will be a major blow to the world. And to go through another dark ages could be a real possibility. I don't sugarcoat this.
Christopher, you and I have had a wonderful conversation, and thank you so much for all that you've shared with us today. I also just want to add that I'm so grateful that you are part of the team on New Thinking Aloud, and it is a great joy to work alongside you and also your life partner, personal producer, and associate producer of New Thinking Aloud, Valerie Jones. Thank you so much for being with me today.
Emmy, it's a great delight, and I hope you will afford me the opportunity to turn the tables on you. I would love to do an interview with you, especially with all of your intuitive knowledge. Please allow me the honor of doing that.
Yeah, that would be a great joy.
Thank you.
And for those of you listening or watching, thank you for being with us. You are the reason that we are here.
Book 2 in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book series is a tribute to parapsychologist Russell Targ, celebrating his 90th birthday.